Shelly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
July 21 or 7-21, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because I'm babbling a bunch of numbers at you, telling you when it is. Anyway, doesn't matter. A lot of you will catch this further on down the stream via your Fondle Slab of choice, your applicable application, or your podcatcher du jour, or maybe some mixture of all of the above later as a podcast. Yes, indeed. It's Thursday, so in the first hour, we have Michael Swanson with us. Thank God Mike Swanson is with us. Okay. Second hour is a little bit up in the air, but no worries at all, because if all you got was Mike Swanson tonight, you still got way more than the cost of admission, which is zero, because this show goes out for free. And even if there was an admission cost, you get the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, the author of The War State, the author of Why the Vietnam War. Oh, we might be discussing some stuff about the Vietnam War tonight. Maybe. We'll see. Who knows what else? Be in the know, though. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. And it's not just about Wall Street. There's a lot of other things going on there. Hang on a second. There we go. I've just had to hit the mic stand really quickly. And I hear a squeaky door behind me. But anyway, we are live. Mike, before I start talking about other things and what might go on in the second hour, how about if I check in with you? What's going on with you? We didn't hear from you last week, sir.
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm just trying to catch up on some stuff. Actually, you mentioned the book, Why the Vietnam War. I released that last year.
Right.
But I'm now going, you know, after I released it, around January, February, a year ago, I just kind of put it to the side, and I just picked it up to and I'm rereading it and actually looking for any mistakes or typos or anything like that. A couple of people on Amazon said that there are mistakes in it, so I'm trying to you know, find them, I guess.
Well, look, to my memory, there's nothing glaring horrible, but then again, you know, the blind guy telling you how many mistakes you have in your book. It happens.
Well, they're not talking about... Well, one of them said I misspelled someone's name, which I did find that. They were correct. Yeah. But what I did when I wrote the book, I had multiple people edit it, and... I read it over and over and over again. When you do that, you can't see the mistakes anymore.
Right.
And I think the next time I put a book, I mean, it's not that they're not finding, these people aren't complaining about factual mistakes. Just I misspelled someone's name and
no. Let's get that straight. There are not errors, at least not that I know of, regarding facts or stuff that you're citing. It's not like your citations are off or no. Yeah, like you said, the misspelling maybe here or there. I mean, it happens, and quite honestly, some of the stuff that you might have misspelled is not necessarily definitively, well, spelled one way. Because when I read stuff on the Vietnam War, especially, honestly, the stuff that was out, you know, 20, 25 years ago, your spellings could vary from author to author on all kinds of stuff. And I've seen, you know, I mean, everybody goes, okay, well, why don't you just Google it? Yeah, but when you do that, even you find that sometimes the acceptable version of the word is not necessarily the correct way to spell it either. It's a bit confusing, Mike, to be honest with you, about especially when you're talking about stuff, you know, where you could be talking about a region or somebody's name, or, you know, I've seen in official files where you have two different spellings of the same guy's name before, you know what I mean? And you're like, well, which one is actually correct? You know, it's not that easy to do, to be honest. So, look, there's no major errors in that thing. I mean, again, typographical type stuff where, yeah, somebody's name might be in question. I get it.
Well, the thing I'm trying to, I'm want to start working on the next book, but and then I look back and saw these people make these comments and then decided to reread it. But when I put the book out, it's doing pretty good. I mean, the vast majority of the reviews are really positive on there. Mm-hmm. And but I haven't really done anything to try to promote it. And part of the reason why is that the book has a thesis to it.
Well, we do run a book commercial on here and all the podcasts that come through. You know, I haven't done anything to promote it. Well, I do run the book commercial through everybody's podcasts. Why the Vietnam War?
Oh, no, I'm sure that helps the sales. But, I mean, myself, I never really tried to do a whole lot. Talked about it once, and I did a show with Leonard Sanek. That's about it. But part of the reason why is I really want people, you know, I don't really feel like I want to run around, and I'm going to hint at it in this talk, and then I want to get into some new stuff that nobody knows about, about the Vietnam War, except Larry Hancock, because he referred me to it.
Right.
But the book I wrote, it has a really unique thesis to it that's not in other books about the Vietnam War. And instead of going on podcasts and making declarations of it, I really want people to see the evidence, you know. And I don't even flat out necessarily spell out what the thesis of the book is in the book,
because
the evidence to speak for itself.
Yeah, actually, I was going to say that you don't really push a particular idea in the book. However, over time, you've shared things with me, and I think while you were still writing, you shared some of the stuff that was going to go into the book. And maybe it was Larry. And by the way, anybody who wants to know, Larry Hancock is currently kind of out of action, but he's doing okay as far as I know, and we'll be hearing from him again, but it's not going to be in the next few weeks, just so everybody knows that, because a lot of times Larry follows you on the show. But he had a bit of a medical situation, and I don't know how much of that he wants to share publicly, but just want to let everybody know that he is okay, but had a bit of a bumpy ride there for a bit. But anyhow, Larry has often come up with a lot of interesting documentation or things that don't necessarily comport with something that he's writing about, and he's often freely shared them or pointed them out to other people. As have you among, you know, the people that you know. You've said, hey, look, you guys should take a look at this. I note that quite often, frankly, even though JP's not on the show anymore, a lot of times there's an email I get, and it'll be just, you sent it to me and JP, right?
Oh, I still do that.
Yeah, and, you know, and we get, and this is not just on Vietnam, by the way, but I love that you like to show us stuff that we're not necessarily seeing elsewhere. I think by the time you're done with your series, you might have a very unique collection of interesting stuff. But you don't push a thesis, per se, in the book. But it is different. And also, I don't know how much good it would do you to go on a lot of podcasts about it right away, because I think you got more work to do, honestly. And by the time you do it, you're going to have a serious preponderance of evidence for a thesis, whether you decide to spell it out directly or not, that will make it, a little less contentious when you go on some of these places, because you know, a lot of people who want to talk to you about this have a very certain set idea about the conflict, how it was prosecuted, what it actually means, what the government was doing at the time, and some of what you're going to write about here might, well, conflict with that a little bit, won't it?
Yeah, in the Vietnam, you know, I went to a conference, time goes by, in 2013 or 2011 or something. Mm-hmm. 2016.
Well, there was the one that you went to the year before.
17, I don't know.
Well, look, there was a couple of them there. There was one in 2016 and one in 2017 before you went to Lancer, right?
It was 2017, yeah.
Okay.
So Anyway, it was Jacob Hornberger put it on in the Northern Virginia area. Oliver Stone spoke, and Jim DeEugenio spoke, and he gave some sort of presentation about the Vietnam War. I don't remember all the details of it, but he made one comment, and I'm just not even saying it right, but that I don't remember the exact words he used, and he did a better job than I'm going to do describing this, but yeah. He said in history, perhaps he might have said science too. Okay, for example, right now, I saw a story before we got on the show
saying
it's linked to on the Drudge Report. It's saying the headline says something like scientists claim or say that chemical imbalances in the brain do not cause depression. Well, I went and clicked the article, and it's saying that there's no proof that low serotonin levels cause people to be depressed. It says 10,000 people have been studied, and there's no real correlation. One of the implications is that these antidepressants that are prescribed may not, be effective. They may not, because they're all supposed to boost these levels. But the point of the story is that here's a story of something that is, way out there in the field of psychiatry. At the end of the story, a psychiatrist says, look, you can't take this study seriously. You've got to do what individually is right for the patient. And if they respond to medicine, you got to keep giving it to them. I'm not to argue they're right, just to say that here's a scientific thing where there's a dispute about something that has been accepted in the psychiatric profession since like 1980 as common sense to them.
SSRIs. Now here's the thing about SSRIs is that this has morphed over the years depending on which version of conventional thinking you're looking at, right? So you have people that have said that these things were like the miracle cures at one point in the 80s and the 90s, and then you have people questioning it, saying that, well, look, this may not be right for the things that they're prescribing it for. There was a bit of a pushback, and honestly, what I conclude out of all this, and I've taken some of these things. I've known a lot of people who have taken them. I got to tell you that it's a crapshoot. When people take them, the effects, it's not like, look, you and I could be very similar in a lot of ways, and yet we'll take one of these drugs and we'll have completely different, reactions. Okay. And I got to say that in general, I have come to a conclusion after some time that I find these things to be dangerous and hazardous more than anything. Now, that's not to say that they're not effective and useful for some people.
Well, look, you may say that, but I bet you 90% of these psychiatrists would disagree with you.
Well, right, but see,
and you may make them angry. They may go on a camp. If you really try to talk about this and do more and more shows, do shows about it, they may attack you. They may petition YouTube to take you down.
I've already gotten
and
letters.
You may become a real villain if you really got big.
I've already I'm not even that big, and I've already gotten letters, Mike. And I got to tell you that 35 years ago, 35 years ago, when they were prescribing this stuff to me initially, it was, there was a whole situation as to why that was done, but I got that stuff prescribed to me. It was debatable at that time whether it was even remotely safe to give to an adolescent of any kind, because 35 years ago, I was 15, right? And the idea was that they were saying that, maybe this isn't good to give to kids. Nowadays, stuff is prescribed to kids that 20, 30 years ago would have been absolute insanity to give to a kid, okay? A bunch of the stuff that is commonly prescribed, even for stuff like ADD and all that, it's insane. They would have never allowed that to be given to a kid a few years ago. I'm just saying that the dynamics of this are constantly changing.
Yeah.
And the profession itself has changed its own points of view several times. Although they have consistently stuck with this is all a good thing, it's just as to who it's good for, who it's not good for, so on and so forth. And today, if you go over to Drudge Report, all the big headlines over there are about, you know, whether Biden has COVID or not. Or COVID or cancer, allegedly. So, you know, there's that happening. And the Drudge Report, you got to remember, the headline always beats out what the facts are in the story. I'm not saying that it's not interesting, but, you know, Drudge is Drudge. You can go all over the place. You can go to the journals of record in the psychiatric community, and you can find all sorts of debates about this stuff, no matter what. And then you got to sort through who's actually being funded by the makers of the drugs, stuff like that, like a lot of these studies. You know,
well, I'm just trying to – the thing – Jim DiEugenio was saying was in the historical field, yeah, there's a similarity in which there are things that are commonly accepted, right, and a debate will take place around the topic, but most of that debate will revolve around some commonly accepted conclusions. So he made the argument that when the Oliver Stone movie came out and said that Kennedy was going to withdraw from Vietnam, that that thesis at the time of the movie was not accepted,
right,
at all. You know, John Newman made it, Fletcher Prouty made it, Peter Dale Scott made it.
Right.
But they were not, they were not big figures in academia in history departments. You know, Newman had a PhD. I don't think at the time he was teaching anywhere. Peter Dale Scott had an English degree.
Right.
And Fletcher Prouty, you know, was writing in some magazines and stuff. They were not established figures in the field of history,
right,
and their thesis was not part of the debate. And
It wasn't even acceptable to debate about it at that time.
Yeah.
And by the way,
now,
it's still a debate.
You know,
a debate, but at least it's there, being acknowledged somewhat, to the point of even when we talked about the Ken Burns thing, right? And I was saying to you, look at how they're just doing this, you know, oh, it was a continuation and Johnson was, you know, some hapless victim who was pulled into this. And I told you right then and there, I was upset about it because I said, you know, haven't we already been through, 30 years of debate on this where, you know, it was hard enough to get somebody to even look at the idea that maybe this wasn't Kennedy's intent to do this. And we also talked about virtual JFK. I mean, there's been a lot of steps along the way, but what you and I talk about, or what alternative historians talk about, like you said, it's not part of the equation when it comes to the generally accepted, you know, the, who's the guy who just completely poo-poos everything about the Kennedy assassination, who is the biggest mainstream historian still alive. Why is his name eluding me? But you know who I'm talking about. And these guys who are historians, in quotes, they wouldn't even touch that debate. Now it's in there, and there is a debate, but these things take time, and they do take time to be introduced. Oliver Stone is one step in that process, but there were many people trying to introduce that idea in. And, yeah, it is an interesting thing, because if you look at the evolution of the psychiatric industry, there's been a lot of things that they would have said some years ago that were definitive that today are either not politically acceptable or are not part of their, physician's desk reference, right? The DSM. So, you know, I mean, the easiest thing to throw a stone at one time, homosexuality was generally just considered to be a mental disorder, period. Yeah, that's not part of the psychiatric convention at this point, is it? So, you know, these things do evolve. They do change over time. And it's interesting to see what happens when you're talking about the way that historical events are sort of couched to people over time. And I've talked to you about how the postmodern sort of version of historical literature, the way it changed with the rise and fall of the Third Reich and all that, how we got things in a more immediate sense, because otherwise you had to wait 75 years to write about it as a historian, right, in order to give it a perspective, as the French would say, and all that. So, yeah, but continue on, because D'Eugenio's making this point about the Vietnam War, I guess, at this presentation.
This was in 2017, and that was the point he was making. And myself, you know, reading over the literature of the Vietnam War, which frankly I was doing since I was in graduate school, a long time ago.
Right.
I wrote my BA thesis was about the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have written that in 96 or 97 or something.
Another thing that changed over time. Right, because
now it's pretty much undeniable that the second attack didn't happen.
Right. So you have this alleged attack that we were supposed to be, responding to with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and all this, and now again in the mainstream, even it is accepted that you have
now.
A
what I found when I wrote it, I contacted a professor. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he was writing a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of historical documents that hadn't been used yet.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent them to me, and I talked with someone that was on one of the boats. Mm-hmm. But in the documents, there's a transcript of one of Johnson's National Security Council meetings around 5 or 6 o'clock the day of the second attack, or the day following it, and he's making the decision to bomb, to announce on television that he's bombing. And in that transcript, McNamara responds to somebody asking whether they have proof of whether it happened or not, and he says they don't. Mm-hmm. And they won't know for sure until the next day. What they'll be able to do is, when daylight comes over there, you look for signs in the water of some sort of wreckage or something that's happened.
Something, yeah.
Yeah, so I wrote in the thing, and it was new to the professor missed it. You know, that's why you need more eyes than one, and doing this stuff.
Yeah.
But that statement by McNamara suggests that he had doubt and they didn't have proof, right then. But anyway, one of the problems with the topic of the Vietnam War, the debates about it, is these, I see so many of these debates that still go on,
mm-hmm,
as meaningless or just ridiculous. So a lot of people still want to argue whether we could have won the war. And they come out with books saying this, and some of them will make arguments that, if we just didn't do this one thing, we could have won. So, for instance, this book about Lansdale that came out by Max Boot a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
He made there's some interesting stuff in the book, but he tried to spin it by making the argument that if we just listened to Lansdale and stuck of his counterinsurgency instead of did the type of war that happened when LBJ came in with the mass bombing, maybe we could have won. He doesn't show any proof of that. To me, he's just kind of making this argument just to have an argument to justify the book. But There's other authors that have claimed that Diem was winning the war, and if he just wasn't killed and betrayed, maybe we could it could have been won. That's which is total nonsense.
Yikes, yeah. You know?
Total nonsense. The listeners familiar with John Newman can read his book about what the intelligence reports showed when he was alive. There's other reasons. It's just nonsense. But it's more like they're trying to make political arguments about the war, you know, to blame people for it. You know, if we just didn't stop bombing in the 70s, we could have won. You know, I mean, stuff like that. And I just don't even care to I think it's a waste of time.
Well, the only time so I ever entertained
but
that,
I'm interested yeah. in the things, you know, mm-hmm. I'm trying to argue are way outside of what these people are arguing. And today I was listening to a podcast that had it's called American Exception. I think you've spoken with that guy.
Yeah.
But anyway, Aaron Good.
Yeah, at one point, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, he had a podcast with Daniel Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott. They talked about Watergate and Vietnam. And in this podcast, Ellsberg said one of the things I'm arguing about, making the argument for, implying, you know, implicitly trying to do, that no one has said anywhere else. And here I heard someone say it. And that is that when Kennedy was president, that whole Laos crisis was basically the Joint Chiefs of Staff trying to get Kennedy to go to war with China. They were trying to use Laos as a stepping stone to go into war with China, bombing North Vietnam and then using nuclear weapons against China. And LeMay said they should do it. This is the crisis that happened during the Bay of Pigs. Another figure in the Joint Chiefs of Staff said it. And they had a regional war plan that they wanted him to implement the first step of. And that plan was discontinued. It's called CETO Plan 5. It was you send a couple troops to Laos to deter the North Vietnamese in China from intervening there. And then if they do, you send more troops and you bomb North Vietnam. And then you launch, if that doesn't stop them, then you launch a nuclear attack on a Chinese naval facility, a military facility. Well, that plan was scrapped around 1962, and the planning was redirected towards Vietnam. They essentially flipped out Laos and inserted Vietnam in its place, and they tried to push that plan onto Lyndon Johnson in 1964. And he obviously escalated the war, but not in the way that they wanted him to. But anyway, Ellsberg is basically making that, flat out makes that argument about Laos that, you know, I just put the facts that back up in my book, but I haven't seen anyone else ever say it or anywhere, much less put it in a book. So I thought that was kind of interesting to listen to.
No, definitely. And look, there's a lot more to this. And quite honestly, when the different readings of how it could have been, how it was, and everything else with this war is really fascinating to me. I mean, I told you about the various veterans I've spoken to who have different views about this, who were there, you know. And I always have to temper that in my mind with, well, you know, how much did this guy actually know about what was going on? You know, he might have known about what he did day to day, but did he know about, you know, what was going on throughout the rest of the country? What was the point of the conflict? All that. I mean, literally, I have the weirdest thing going on in the chat room where somebody thinks that the war was lost because, I don't know, Ford had no power or something, he says. Very odd to me, the different viewpoints of, you know, gee, if we would have just done this, it would have been a victory. I don't know. Those things always make me shake my head. As you said, I don't even want to engage in it anymore. You know, it's like, look, the conflict was a disaster, and it just depends on, you know, what part of the disaster you want to examine. As for laying blame on, you know, who prosecuted it, I always find that to be strange, too, because a lot of people take it back and say it's all Kennedy's fault. And I'm not one of these Kennedy apologists. See, that's an odd thing about some people when it comes to this discussion, is they absolutely don't want to put any responsibility on John Kennedy. And they put it all on Johnson, none of it on Nixon. You know, it's like a very weird kind of, I don't know what to make of it with this, like, a sort of partisan view of the Vietnam War. Again, I'm just, you know, an amateur historian of sorts. So I can't read all the history as well as I guess some other people do. But, you know, and I'm not a guy like you who's maybe a little more educated in these things than I am, but... Yikes. It's like a Rorschach test, you know? And when you confront people with documentation that conflicts with, you know, their position, it's very strange to watch. It's very, very strange to watch. And quite frankly, I don't think that there's a clear, concise answer about a lot of the questions still with that conflict, which again ended in what, 76, right? So... You know, but, you know, blaming Ford for the loss in Vietnam is kind of like blaming Biden on Afghanistan in my mind, but maybe I'm crazy still. Anyway, Mike, I know you got, you're going to do two more of these, right?
Yeah, probably. Well, let me tell you something really new, or to me at least, and again, this is only in one book that I know of. It came out in 2020, and Larry Hancock told me to write this. But take a guess: how many troops do you think China sent to North Vietnam?
Wait, say that again.
How many troops do you think China sent to North Vietnam at one time?
You know, I don't recall reading a definitive number about this. And I will say that the first problem is that you have to go back to the end of World War II for some of the things that started to happen in that region, don't you? I mean, because American involvement, a lot of people think, just started in, you know, what, 1960, right? That's not true. And also, there's a lot going on there before the Americans arrive anyway. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Come to think of it, I'm trying to think through in my head how many troops would have been introduced by China. I don't know.
Yeah. Larry Hancock recommend I read this book called The Dragon in the Jungle. And it's based on Chinese sources. And the whole question of that I asked you something I've never thought about myself, and you just don't think about it. I thought, like, the government of Vietnam today, they've put out a history of the Vietnam War that has an English translation. I read it, and it didn't have this figure in it. And it talks a lot about, you know, my impression was there were a small number of Soviets in North Vietnam helping with anti-aircraft defense. And that book didn't really say much about this Vietnamese official history. Well, this book, again, this is written from Chinese sources. The author lives in the United States. Mm-hmm. He's a professor in Oklahoma, but it says he served in the People's Liberation Army in China. So he's a native Chinese. But anyway, here's a fact in the book. In 1966, mm-hmm. China sent 180,000 troops into North Vietnam.
No kidding.
180,000. That's a lot of people.
That's a fairly sizable force that they introduced that, quite frankly, most people don't bring up at all. Okay.
No. Now,
given, though, that is from a Chinese source, right? Now, I'm not one of these people that says, oh, China, they're lying. I'm not one of those people, but again, I like to see things verified by more than one cohort that has an interest in telling a story, right? So is that questionable? I mean, is there what is the relative proof for it outside of what the Chinese government's declaration that they did this? Is there anything else that would be able to show us that this is verifiable? Like, does somebody else take note of this, I wonder? You would think that somewhere in the American documentation we might find that they're aware that they're running into. I mean, because some of those forces would have to have been killed in combat. They must know that sometime they're encountering Chinese forces. I mean, I'm assuming they'd be in.
Well, they weren't fighting. The U.S., what they were doing mm-hmm. was reserve work. Although they were in the army, they were basically doing the repair work of roads and some railroads, roads for trucks and some railroads. Really? So all the bombing that the U.S. was doing, destroying their infrastructure, according to this book, it was being repaired by these Chinese soldiers. They weren't fighting. They were all support troops. Now, they would have a small contingent of anti-aircraft battalions uh-huh. to defend okay. themselves. But by the count of this book, these anti-aircraft forces were primitive. They were basically from the Korean War. Okay. And they weren't very effective at all at shooting down American planes. Yes, it says they shot down a couple of them.
Right.
But the Soviets, had missile technology that they're bringing in, much better technology that was up to date. The Chinese technology way behind, but it was basically China was sending these support people in to do the repair work in order to free up the Vietnamese to do the fighting. Now, according to the book,
right.
China saw the war itself as a direct threat against possibly a threat against them. And that's why they did it. They didn't want the North Vietnamese to lose.
Okay.
Because then for the same reasons, they intervened in the Korean War. They didn't want, they were content to have the country divided, Vietnam too, but they did not want it united under an American ally, because then we would be in a position to, they could be in a position to be directly threatened. Just like today in Europe, when Putin invades Ukraine, Poland, and the surrounding countries, if Putin takes over the entirety of Ukraine, then they feel directly threatened. They could be next.
Okay.
So they're content. If it means having a war go on forever to escape that possibility, they're willing to let that happen in Ukraine.
Yeah, I don't know. It's such a small theater to be working in, though. I don't know that I could agree that this is going to be, because I see this being floated now in some mainstream discussions.
Well, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to.
I got you, but let's go back to this. Yeah, let's go back to this.
Definitive statement there.
Yeah, let's go back to this thing, though, with China introducing these troops for support, because, okay, I remember reading intelligence reports, right? Some of the military intelligence reports about them being sort of stunned at how fast, no matter what it was, they blew up, right? And we've seen
various, they'd be repaired instantly.
Yeah, it was like instantaneous repairs. And frankly, our intelligence guys seem to be just mystified by this. Like, they couldn't explain it. We saw even in that Ken Burns thing, you know, when you weren't falling asleep, right? it was really a snooze fest. But, I mean, even there, they were talking about we would go out and repair this stuff. They made it sound like it was a very organic local effort, right, to do this themselves. There was no mention there of, you know, assistance from outside of the country coming in to help them with it. I don't recall that being in any of the U.S. intelligence reports. So, I'm not trying to challenge you, Mike. I'm just saying that thinking back over it, nobody else noticed this? That it would be Chinese nationals that were sent in to do this?
Well, it's an interesting thing because if these Chinese... I don't doubt they're Chinese. I don't know how many, you know.
I don't doubt they sent some troops in. I don't contend that, you know, I'm not, like, arguing with that at all. What I'm saying is, first of all, it's 180,000. That's a fairly noticeable cohort if they sent it all in at once. I can't see how they could...
Well, okay, I'll say this about that.
Okay.
There's a document I read... when was it? Is when Kennedy made the decision... In 1961, when they were pressuring Kennedy to send troops over there,
right.
Walter Rostow, Maxwell Taylor... Okay. And Lansdale, actually, was along with them. But the whole contingent of these guys went to Vietnam, and they came back with a report in 1961 telling right. Kennedy to send, you know, to intervene, and had recommendations to send combat troops, and he rejected them. But one of the funny things in there is that in the Taylor section, he said something to the effect that there are troops outside Vietnam, in Cambodia,
yeah,
in Laos, and we have no idea how many there are, and there could be, you know, hundreds of thousands of them, basically. So, just based on that, I don't think they always knew how many troops were going on and what was happening. Another interesting memo, an honest memo, is in the run-up to the Diem coup, mm-hmm. There's a trip, you know, all these people are always, different people are taking trips to Vietnam, and Roger Hilsman goes on a trip with someone else over there,
right.
And they do a write-up of and saying the situation's getting a lot worse, and McGeorge Bundy, who's in Kennedy's national security advisor, he writes a memo to Kennedy saying, you know, the comments here are, you know, this is interesting what they're saying, and he says something to the effect, we really don't know what's going on over there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lot to it, that in if the number isn't 180,000 and 60,000 that the Chinese sent over there, it's still a lot more people than people ever even think about. And as you mentioned, it's written out of the history. You know, the Ken Burns show doesn't say a word about China sending anyone to Vietnam. And there were Soviets in Vietnam.
Sure.
And they weren't mentioned in there.
Right.
And the Vietnam government does not have a good relationship with China. So I can see why they would kind of, you know, downplay or minimize the role they had.
Okay.
The two countries, in fact, China invaded them in 78 and 79. Let me read you something, too, that's pretty wild in this book.
Well, really, really quickly before you go there, I mean, look, for there to be an honest assessment, that they don't exactly know what's going on makes a lot of sense, because when it comes to these border countries, right, and just adjacent lands, there could have been all sorts of sympathetic assets of one type or another, because if you notice, there was a lot of descriptions there about the, you know, the border crossing, where there would be attacks and then these guys would retreat across borders into other countries, right? And they're going, well, we don't know exactly who is running these operations, and this was going on back and forth. I think there's a lot of stuff going on, fog of war here, that probably nobody ever solved when it comes to who was actually backing it and stuff like this, because go ahead.
There's another key thing, too, about this China thing. They were only there for a short period of time. They withdrew in 1969. Mm-hmm. So they're not there after that. In fact, there's another book I read a couple years ago that's based on Vietnamese sources.
Yeah.
The lady's Vietnamese, and I think she's – I don't remember if she's born there or here, but she goes – you know, she got – sources from Hanoi,
right.
And wrote a book about, there's like two or three books about their perspective of the war using their sources. And they, that book makes the argument that when Nixon did his bombing in the 70s,
right,
he got permission from China first and they gave it to him.
Which which would make some sense, considering that he was establishing those relations there. And if this was going to be a touchy subject with China, right? Because what was his big thing? He's opening up China. He goes and meets with Mao, right?
So here's something pretty wild in this. You just don't think about. So I just want to go through quickly two pages in here. This says, which is backed up in the other books I've read, Vietnam moved closer to the Soviet Union in 1970 to 1972. The Chinese technology was futile by then. The Soviet air system so much superior. Mao figured by then China cannot win. Listen to this. Marshal Lin Bao, China's defense minister, and he was actually like one of the very top people in the Chinese government, the defense minister, obviously, says he gets killed later on. That's a whole other story. But as defense minister, his lieutenants considered the Soviet Union as a more immediate threat to China than the United States by 1968. When the Soviet Red Army invaded Czechoslovakia in 1978, its troops broke into the Chinese embassy and savagely beat Chinese diplomats unconscious. While this tension mounted, Soviets deployed a large number of Red Army troops along the Soviet-Chinese border. The Chinese prime minister told the Vietnamese prime minister, now the Soviet Union is encircling China. The circle is getting complete, except the part of Vietnam. By the end of the year, Moscow sent more troops from 17 divisions to 27 divisions along the border with China. By 1969, China was apparently under tremendous pressure and felt directly threatened by the Soviet Union. They began to prepare for the possibility of a nuclear conflict.
Huh.
Thereafter, the country became militarized and prepared also for an invasion. This all impacted their relations with Vietnam.
Right.
And the Soviets actively undermined whatever remaining influence the Chinese had with them. Hanoi continued to send delegations to Beijing, but reciprocity ended.
Yeah, it's look, it's a long winding road here, and
I mean that's pretty wild. You know?
Yeah, I look, it's a long winding road because again the very curious and of course they would describe it as the American War of Aggression, right? It's a different perspective for sure. I don't know what to make of some of this stuff where it's just completely flies in the face of everything that you see otherwise. It's very weird. There's a whole lot going on there. You know, the people that don't even talk about the conflict between the Buddhists and the Catholics there, miss
which
a lot
that,
of,
and that goes on yeah. for years. It's not just during DM that, no. that plays a big role in the,
right. You know. I mean, but that's
look,
the thing.
There's the
yeah.
thing about it, Chuck, is there's so much about the war that like, you know, is still not known.
Yeah.
Look, I'll just tell you something that's hinted at in a few sources, and I don't know if it's true or not. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But with Lansdale, you know, and Ellsberg and Lansdale goes back to Vietnam mm-hmm. in the mid 1960s, and to try to do counterinsurgency, right. his group. I don't remember if it's there for like 1 or 2 years and it doesn't, it kind of gets bureaucratically outmaneuvered, but for a period of time, Ellsberg is there with them mm-hmm. trying to help them. And, the Max Boot book, I think it's in there, says that they thought about trying to help another leader take control that would be more reformist and make it more democratic than it was. It wasn't at all, but
yeah no, I look, the whole thing is very it's quite an eclectic mix of possibilities here and stuff like that. I mean, yikes. I just look, I'm looking forward to what it is you're going to put together in these next two volumes, to be honest with you, because a lot needs to be written about this that has not been written. There is a lot of stuff that should be studied and needs to be really dissected that has not been done yet. There is just so much to it. You know, at the end of the day, to me, it's still something that I don't believe that the there was good interest for this country to get involved in. You know, why we didn't take the lessons from the French and their attempts to handle things, you know, in that region of the world, right? When it comes to their colonial operations, why it is we couldn't take cues from them after they had suffered as they did is still a mystery to me. Why it is that we were engaged for so long, why it is we seem to achieve zero objectives, in my mind. I mean, again, I get arguments from people that, oh no, it was just this close to winning, if, and so on and so forth. It's very strange. That whole concept about Nixon needing permission from China is actually a fairly sensible thing, you know, or at least getting a sort of a green light from them, because let us not forget the reason why there is a North and South Korea is because, what, the Chinese got involved there, didn't they? And as soon as they did, this is the result we ended up with, the war that didn't really come to an end, right?
Well, by that time, the other element of this is in Cambodia, Pol Pot takes over mm-hmm. and kills lots of people, but he was a Chinese ally or mm-hmm. puppet,
yeah,
and the North Vietnamese were against him. And they try to do an incursion against Cambodia, and the U.S. backs Cambodia.
Yeah.
And China, you know, we were supporting China and Pol Pot, you know, exterminated or killed.
Which is still the strangest thing in
so
the world.
So many people. And yeah. That's, where's that in the Ken Burns show?
Yeah, where is that exactly? I mean, look, the thing is that it is the strangest thing to see, because Ho Chi Minh himself actually thought, and he was making appeals to the U.S. to have them back him. And he literally seemed to think, according to a lot of sources, actually, that the U.S. would back him. Because it was, you know, everybody's like, oh, they were communist. It wasn't really that clear to begin with exactly where they were going with this, you know. The whole thing is just, it's such a, I don't know. I don't envy the position that you're in coming up with these next two volumes. But, you know, I can't wait for when, are you going to at some point, though, really put in the definitive thesis for what you have in mind here? Because I have an idea about where you're going with this first book. And I do say, get the book. You know, anybody's listening, Why the Vietnam War? It's available on Amazon and all that good stuff. Get it. But as you go further in this, I mean, are you going to really lay out exactly your overall conclusions about the whole circumstance? I mean, there's a lot of details to go through here, and you're really great at making sure that those are easily relatable. But I mean, are we going to get that in volume three or what?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Not sure. Do you have a definitive conclusion that you think you have a narrative here that's different from other people's that you could, if you wanted to, really lay out really quickly if I were to ask you for it? I'm not asking you to do it. But do you have an idea about an alternative narrative that is already in your hand, or is that still developing in your mind?
I'm still developing the stuff.
Okay. Because that's what it seemed like to me. And I was just curious, you know, sometimes people have things in their minds they keep in their back pocket till the end, right? But for me, I'm enjoying this. I want to see where you go. And look, no offense, but I mean, I don't know how much of it you're going to be able to make sense of, not because of you, but because the information is so odd about this. I mean, from the beginning of U.S. involvement, the truth about it, when you peel away some of the layers, we were there a lot longer than, well, the mainstream historian will tell you, right? You have different motivations by different administrations. You have the prosecution of the war. McNamara being a key figure, sure, but he's not there the entire time. Okay? We have the way that it ended. And we have this very interesting sort of aftermath where, you know, there's been a lot of interesting things back and forth between Vietnam post-war and us, so to speak, right? I mean, are you going to at some point write about the POWs and all that and that whole situation?
Well, I mean, if I get up to the Nixon presidency, yeah, because they became real important then.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, this could bring you into other presidential candidates like Ross Perot. I mean, I'm just saying, you don't know where this...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's endless. So many topics.
Yeah. No, for sure.
I can't cover all of it.
But, for sure. And, okay, so anyway, I know I kind of dragged you over time a little bit, but as I told you, you know, we started a little late, so I'm glad that you stuck with me. Mike Swanson, of course, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, the author of The War State, a book I definitely advise that you read if you want to understand, 20th century American history. How about that? Anyway, it's definitely in context one of the more interesting required pieces of reading as far as I'm concerned. But this very curious first volume out of a proposed three, according to Mike, Why the Vietnam War? Which, to me, is the ultimate largest question, actually. Why was this necessary? Why? You know, and I've got a lot of thoughts about that, but I'm not the one writing the book. So I can't wait to see where you go with it. And any idea when we might see the next volume, by the way, Mike?
Oh, I haven't even seen it. I got to write it, so I'm not sure.
No, I know. I just thought maybe you had a projected deadline, yeah, something in mind. But sometime in the near future, hopefully, we'll see the other two volumes. And look, I'm looking forward to it and anxious to see where you go, because you have had some information in here that I haven't seen really elsewhere, or at least Not very much. It's not the most common information. It's not the most common line of thought. And as you said, you don't have a definitive thesis laid out in the first volume for sure. And that's unique in and of itself. Somebody writing about this war who doesn't come into it pretty much with a preset agenda, which is really interesting as far as I'm concerned. That Ken Burns snooze fest, though. Man, oh, man. I still have bad memories from it, Mike. You and me going over that, trying to... Well, we really wanted to see it, too, because it was supposedly all this new information. And the only thing that was really good about it is you actually had people from the other side. It wasn't just the American side of the narrative, but still, man, oh, man, it just killed me. And how many times did I have to hear about poor Lyndon Johnson, you know, being... somehow, I don't know, bullied into engaging in the war in Vietnam. I don't think that that's true for a second, but, you know, Ken Burns is entitled to his opinion, so long as the Koch brothers and the Ford Foundation and all of your good friends and corporate sponsors over there at PBS want to support him, he'll be able to put out what he wants. But I urge you to get Mike's work on this, and who knows, maybe we'll get into some other stuff like this in the near future. Are you going to be on with me next week, Mike?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Excellent. It's always a better Thursday when Mike Swanson is with us. Maybe we'll get into some current events, too, because, you know, I wanted to talk to you about Netflix and this very weird thing that's going on with stocks. I mean, is anybody getting any sort of benefit from the gas price finally starting to trickle downward? I don't know, but, hey, we could talk finance next time, Mike, or maybe not. Who knows, right?
Yep. We'll talk about something. Sounds good.
Exactly.
Have a good night.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Always good to talk to you. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street. That's Mike Swanson's website. Check it out over there. You can be much, much better informed if you do. And also, like I said, the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War. Plus, hey, a book on Danville, Virginia, if you're interested in that. And some stuff on finance, I think, too. He had a special on his books not too long ago. Didn't get to promote it on the show, but... that's okay. We always promote the books. Anyway, you'll probably hear a commercial or two for some of Mike's books during the break. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect will continue, and I'm not sure what we're doing in the next hour, so you can be surprised right along with me. Stick around.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so...
Yeah, that is
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too, and look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly...
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show, and I want you to do this, too, because... you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
So I'm interrupting the commercial break just to let you know that my two shots at guests in this upcoming hour did not pan out. So what we're going to do is go to the phones. So if you want to join into the conversation, 319-527-5016. That is where I'll take your calls. And if not, maybe I'll just run off at the mouth for a couple of minutes and get on out of here for this Thursday so I can get to producing the podcast. And I will be releasing the second chapter of Halfway to Hell within the next few days. It's just it's been quite a bit of an editing task to get through it. But anyway, that is all available. And stay tuned to Ocelli.com to find out about some other upcoming events. We're also going to be recording stuff. Well, you know what? I'll get into that once we get back into the live show.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
We'll be right back. Uncle, do you remember that time when the year 2012 was going to create the apocalypse, end of the world?
Right. And it thought it would come to the end.
Did it ever end up that way?
No.
Yeah.
Like we say, the only way it will end is when he is ready for to end. That's how it is.
So if you want the real truth about 2012, you better listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
Radio podcast. .com.
Yeah, forget it's John Cusack.
John Cusack
doesn't know what he's talking about.
Know what he's talking actually about. Correct.
But we here at the Ocelli Radio Network sure do.
Do you understand and understand where it's actually coming from?
Ocelli.com.
Ocelli.com.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
What would I do? Revelation through conversation. In a radio show / podcast. You want the good news? Listen to the Ocelli Effect. Chuck Ocelli is the most underrated voice in all media. News, education, and entertainment. The Daily Bread from Ocelli.com. Go there. Save yourself from ignorance. Ocelli.com. Revelation through conversation. Ocelli.com.
I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before.
So I guess that's around the time the second hour would begin here, but we are a little late on the live stream. Of course, if you're catching this as a podcast later on, yeah, you're not necessarily caring what time it is.
Have you seen the ads lately?
Well, which ad? You talking about the one that makes you look like you're a cyborg and you're going into the future and that? Or the one
that... The one that would piss off anyone that doesn't live in San Francisco. I'm a cisgendered fairy in the woods with three nipples, and now I'm a soldier.
Oh, I didn't see that one. I saw
the
one...
We had a show on it.
Huh. No, I didn't see that one. I saw the one about, you know, basically instead of playing video games, you can be like you are in a video game and be a real life force to reckon with or whatever. I saw that. That's a recent ad where they have some interesting visual effects and stuff. But I didn't see the one with the questionable gender. I didn't see all that.
Really? And not only they did it, but simultaneously Raytheon and Northrop released similar crap. But them having to actually suffer financial consequences actually had to pull their garbage. And finally, I wonder what exactly do civilians have to do with monkeying around with our training and culture to begin with? Yes, I fully understand that they are in charge of war, but since when, what exactual authority do they have to be telling me, we are the professionals, we are the ones that carry out war, who are they to tell us to try to regulate our culture, this, that, or anything, when all they do is deter and weaken our ability to win wars.
In a practical sense, I would tell you only that I do believe it's a good thing to have a civilian decide whether to go to war or not. But after that, you should leave it in the hands of the people that are professionally trained to do it.
Thank you.
I absolutely agree with that. I do think that culture is not the best to make the decision all the time about exactly when we should engage. But once it is done, you kind of got to leave it to the people that you spent millions of dollars training to do it, I think. But, you know, that just seems to be logical to me. I don't know if that's a political statement or not, but it just seems to be the smartest thing to do. you know, let the people that actually trained all their lives to do this send the same young people in and let them do it as efficiently and correctly as possible so that, you know, more of them come home in one piece. That would be nice. That would be the sensible thing to do. Now, does that mean that military culture absolutely would recognize all the angles as to why we should go into a conflict or not? Not necessarily. I gotta say that I don't think that the military is always geared toward diplomatic solutions. And some of those might be better sometimes. But again, once you engage, I think it's lunacy to start screwing with that culture. Because if you're not in it, you're not in it. It's that simple. So I don't get screwing with the machine. Either turn the machine on and send it on its way or don't. But once you do, you got to put trust in the people that you named as the mechanics here. It's that simple. I've always felt that way. You know, even looking at, again, Vietnam, which I've gone over many, many times, and some people argue with me about this, but, you know, I think if people would have listened to Westmoreland, you might have had a better shot at coming up with a better conclusion to the conflict. But they didn't listen to him so well. And by the time they did, a little late, because timing is everything in a conflict. But, again, I get a lot of heat for that nonsense with people that you know, have a certain view of Vietnam or whatever. I mean, to me, it does seem to be a waste, and it does seem to be something that didn't accomplish anything. And I think it was horrific, the amount of damage that it did to a lot of people. And but, you know, again, if you're going to do it, you got to put it in the hands of the people that spent their lives training to do so. That means the old men who got the fruit salad on the front of their shirts. You know what? Those are the guys that you need to leave those decisions to. Anyway, so I don't disagree with you about this whole attempt to screw with the culture. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. I don't get it. I understand they're trying to accommodate it a bit, as, you know, as I think would probably some of them think they're duty bound to accommodate this stuff, but totally understand the resistance of cultural manipulation within the military construct. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. There is no reason for it. If you're not in the military, you have no reason to tamper with the military culture. Now, to say that they shouldn't have dealt with some of this stuff where you had sexual assault going on or extreme hazing going on. No, listen, there's a level of barbaric that you need to accept and a level of barbaric you need not to accept. But outside of that,
there's a uniform code of military justice. If someone rapes someone, they're going to go to a military prison for all their life or get... Well, in the old days, they'd just put a bullet in your head.
Which I don't object to either one. And I don't object to the military meeting out its own justice, if it does. So, I understand this. I understand the code. I can't say that I am part of that culture at all. But that's the thing. I also wouldn't screw with it. You know, let it do what it's supposed to do. Either you do that or you don't. And if you don't want the military that way, well, then you better just break it all down and rebuild it from scratch. Because otherwise, you don't have a functional machine. You just don't. And I'm not somebody who enjoys the idea of war. I'm very anti-war in the first place. But if you're going to engage with the military, yes, you need to trust in the people that are trained to do that.
Where's Chris Graves at? Did I chase him up? Come back, Chris.
He might have hung up. And
where's he at? He mute?
I don't know. He might have hung up.
Is he on mute?
No, he's not on mute. He might have hung up. But it doesn't matter. We're almost through the hour anyway, Jimmy James. Is this all you wanted to discuss? Because Congress, to me, yeah, you know what? Arrest them all and see who you can try for what. And whoever comes out of that, yeah, I guess you can let them back to Capitol Hill. Otherwise, I got no use for
Congress. Say it's the whole Democratic Nationalist Party.
Okay,
they're so in bad with China, and it's so obvious. It's sickening.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to tell you about that, except that it seems to me as though none of these people are representing the people they're supposed to represent. And it doesn't matter if they're on one side or the other. But, okay, you see some good people on the other side. Is there nobody decent on the Democratic side of the equation in your mind? Is it just all absolutely, completely?
Well, let me ask you. No, the entire Congress, there's not one single true Democrat in the whole bunch. Mance is the best they got, and he's not even great. He's not even moderate. He votes 99% of the time with Biden and the rest of his caucus. The entire Democratic Party is nothing more but a bunch of neo-Marxists at this point. The leadership, not necessarily the rank and file.
Okay.
Obviously, I don't know if you've noticed the polls, but people are leaving the Democratic Party. A million people over the last year have switched parties from Democrat to Republican, mostly suburban women, the former backbone of the Democratic caucus over the last 30-ish years, since the soccer mom phenomena.
Okay. Well, they're not liberal.
And oddly enough, supposedly, now I won't believe this till there's actually voting, but supposedly 85% of Hispanics will not vote for Democrat, and supposedly 45% of African Americans won't. Now, this sounds awful hard for even me to believe, but if it turns out that way, it wouldn't surprise me.
All I can see is a huge sweep for the GOP this time, and then if people regret it fast enough, I don't know what happens in 2024, but I'm figuring they'll take back the White House, too. So I think that'll happen, and then people will get disillusioned with that, and then we'll see a swing back the other way. The problem is, though, I do agree with you that there's no such thing as a liberal at this point, because I wish there were liberals. I might agree with them on some things, but they don't really exist. I can't. They're not even coherent enough, this left, to it's like you want to tell me they're all in China's pocket. You know what? I wish they could be coherent enough to do so. I don't believe it.
Because I didn't say they were all in China's pocket.
Oh, okay.
Quite frankly, I think they're in a lot of pockets. The cartel, Russia, China, and he give it the technology, the technologists.
The technocracy crowd there. Yeah, okay. Listen, I'll agree with you on all that. They're in a lot of pockets. The only difference between you and me is I think the Republicans are,
too. What Republicans do those groups support? None. The Republicans are... I wish there was no political parties in the United States. That's what I wish.
Well, I guess we can keep on wishing, Jimmy James. In the next hour, I'm going to talk to Celly Castillo, and I guess Jimmy James might not be happy about it because, I'm going to maybe have to bring up Felix Rodriguez, but who knows what else we're going to bring up regarding the murder of Kiki Camarera and the Mexican drug lords and all that good stuff. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Support Chuck O'Chili at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah,
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too. And, look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly.
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this because, you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his the stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
I saw this on a Betamax tape. I have no idea what the origin was. My uncle just had like had VCRs. Wow. And he had a couple of VCRs in the late 70s. And he had both a Beta and a VHS. And I know it was one of the Betamaxes because it was a smaller tape. And I don't even know where it came from. It was just like, yeah, there's this comedian. Like, he had a bunch of comedians on Betamax tapes. He had like Steve Martin and...
must have had George Carlin's original HBO shows, too, huh? In the late 70s?
Yeah, exactly. He ended up taping that stuff off of HBO, but the Pee Wee Herman thing, I don't even think was off of TV. It was like some, I don't know, like
someone filmed from the back of the theater, huh?
Yeah, like one of those kind of things. Wow. And it was like, and I'm watching Pee Wee Herman, and that's why I was kind of shocked when a couple of years later he becomes a children's...
Children's
television.
Well, you know where he got that idea from? He got that idea from literally from Andy Kaufman. Andy Kaufman told him what he wanted to do right before Andy passed away, supposedly.
Okay.
It was originally supposed to be Uncle Andy's Funhouse, and it turned into Pee-wee's Playhouse after because he kind of gave him his blessing because he knew he was dying of lung cancer. So that's supposedly the story.
Listen, it would not be the strangest thing I ever heard. I just remember that he had, he did weird stuff. He did something with the thing was so adult that he did on the stage. There was some bit he did with a dildo and some, like some other stuff. And I'm like, whoa. I mean, I was like, I don't know, 6 years old, I think, 7 years old the first time I saw
him. So him in the adult movie theater is not that shocking in hindsight, huh?
Not to me. But, you know, to everybody else, it was like, oh, Pee-wee, you know, he's got the cherry and the you know, hi, Jambi, you know.
Hey, Jambi.
What the hell? And I'm going, well, he started out pretty dirty. I mean, you know.
He was, yeah.
And that was the thing. I saw that stage show and... yeah, like you said, when the HBO thing happened, it was kind of like this weird, almost, like it was childlike, but...
He was a man-child, but he was doing all kinds of innuendos and all kinds of adult themes.
Oh, yeah, right. It was like, clearly there's some adult themes in here, but it seems like it's a child thing going on. I don't know, it was very weird. And like I said,
really
I thought it was strange.
Cool, now I think about it.
Yeah, well, I thought it was creepy when it was like, oh, look, he's on, I think it was CBS carried him for a couple of years. Like,
yeah,
super
I watched
successful.
That as a child, TV's Playhouse. Him and Ernest had TV shows at the same time.
Oh, Ernest, there's another
I visited his grave when I made my way across the country last fall. And, Jim Varney, he, besides having a cigarette problem, and he did a little bit of cocaine. I mean, he didn't have the adult movie theater background, but he seemed like a sweetheart. Because he would go to children's hospitals dressed as Ernest, and he'd do it unannounced and things. So I really miss that guy.
Yeah, well, look, a lot of cool people, end up being performers of one type or another. But... No, I just thought it was I thought it was interesting. I was just thinking about the different people that came out of like some of that stuff, like the SCTV, which also came on at a certain point after Saturday Night Live would happen.
Yeah, and then they would all work together in movies. Isn't that kind of cool?
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's where you got John Candy and Eugene Levy, who's, you know, now had sort of a rebirth with his son, I guess, and they do Schitt's Creek.
Oh, yes, Eugene Levy. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's a thing, but I watch these different performers come up, and that was the other thing that I was reminded of when the Hartman thing came about, is that they pretty much, okay, so you had your 70s sort of Saturday Night Live, and then you had your 80s, you know,
Eddie Murphy,
Gilbert Gottfried, you know, this kind
that's
of stuff. And then they had such a horrible time. I think all the way up to, what was it, like 84 to 86, I think it was just absolute disaster.
Lorne Michaels came back in 85, and then he, you know, he recruited John Lovitz, Dana Carvey, Phil
there
Hartman,
you go.
And then,
there you go. And the thing was, I think they started out the season with, like, Madonna coming on stage and reading an apology letter from NBC.
That's right. You're right. They had Kinison on there, too. They had a whole bunch of people on there.
Yeah. Oh, Kinison was hilarious because I want to say that Kinison came on in 85, I think. And
yeah, it was right after the Rodney Dangerfield special, yeah.
Totally got himself banned. Because
right.
He was just, like, absolutely drunk. He was live. And I remember watching the broadcast going, wait a minute, he just dropped an F-bomb. Like, they did not. They would try and catch these things, and it would go, I don't know if people remember this, but it would go dead. Like, the sound would turn off sometimes. Because they
it does
would try
that still, to this day.
Does it?
Super Bowl events and stuff. Yeah, I've seen it recently.
Okay, yeah. I have not. Look, I don't watch TV anymore, but when I used to watch TV on TV, the sound went dead, but they missed a total F-bomb out of Kinison. And they
I
missed.
Think he's the reason why they had the 7-second delay installed, I believe.
Well, whoever was trying to clip it, you know, tried with all their might, but Kinison went, like, full on, like, I'm not on TV. You know,
right.
Just went for it. And, and I was like, and I'm watching that. I think I was, like, 12 or 13 years old. I'm watching this on TV going, wow, okay. he just said the F word.
Well, I got his brother Bill lined up, too, as a possible guest in the future as well. Because he wrote a book about his, called My Brother Sam.
You know,
Brother Sam, rather.
You know what? Very good luck on that one, because I have actually booked Bill twice. So, but I have not gotten him on air.
Thanks for the heads up.
Yeah, I just, you know. And I'd love to talk to Bill Kinison personally. I really would, because I am still a huge, huge fan of Sam.
Me too.
And I was absolutely upset. That's one of the first. That's one of the first famous people I ever remember being upset that they died. Was Sam Kinison.
1992, hit by a drunk teenager in the desert.
Yeah, and I played a show, like, the night he died, or
really?
the next day, and and we actually did, like, we jammed out a version of Wild Thing, like his style, to, like, you know, honor his passing. You know, it was sloppy, it was messy. I'm glad that there's no tape of it out on the internet, but it is. It's one of those things. Sam is some, and I saw him once live at the Ritz in New York City.
During his down period, because there was a long time where he was just too drugged up, like during shows and things.
No, I think it's right before things went real sideways. Like he
before
was
Jessica Hahn.
Yeah, he was definitely, like, still riding the success of the HBO special, the one he did himself.
Oh, okay. So before he started doing movies, right? Like Back to School?
Well, Back to School, see, now my memory's a little weird on this because I thought Back to School was already pretty much out.
1986.
I don't know. Maybe that's the year then, because he was still riding the success of Breaking All the Rules. Because at first, yep, HBO did this thing where they were going to show his special, and then they didn't. And then they did. And now that thing is available in a lot of places. I think Netflix just added it, as a matter of fact. Weirdly.
Are you sure? Because a lot of that with this whole woke thing, a lot of his stuff is like considered, you know, homophobic, misogynistic.
Oh, I'm sure it's got, listen, I'm sure it's got 80 warnings on it because,
okay,
you know, you know how they warn people when people smoke cigarettes now, you know.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
You see sexual content, violence, blah, blah, blah. Smoking.
Tobacco use.
Smoking. You know, like smoking?
Yeah.
Okay, smoking.
Someone didn't put their seatbelt on.
Anyway, no, that didn't used to be a thing, but no, Sam, yeah, during that whole thing, he definitely got a lot of heat for, even at the time, that whole bit he did about, you know, the gay necrophiliacs going around.
That's what I'm
going
to say, the course. Yeah.
And that's how he closed his shows.
Yeah, and, that was later on. Yeah. Wow.
Well, and that's the funny thing is that's on that Breaking All the Rules, that first HBO special that he did by himself. He made the two appearances on Dangerfield.
Yeah.
Right? And then he did the one show by himself. And, yeah, he was still doing...
The bit that blew up for him was the feeding the poor kids in Africa in the desert, like move to where there's move to where the food is.
Yeah, see this is sand. This
is sand. We have that in the United States too. We just don't live in it.
Yeah,
that guy was awesome.
Oh yeah, he was. He was definitely.
You know, Chevy Chase had him cut out of Three Amigos, by the way.
Three Amigos. See, I never heard that before. I know that there was supposed to be a thing for him in Caddyshack 2. And
haven't heard that.
Yeah, they got...
Yeah, no, Three Amigos. John Landis, Chevy Chase with his, you know, his attitude and everything, didn't like Sam and wanted his whole character, his whole sequence cut out. And they cut it out and they lost the footage. And so it's completely lost.
Well, if you remember in Caddyshack 2, somehow they decided not to use Rodney Dangerfield, and they got what was that guy?
The guy who just died. He just died recently. The guy you're about to say.
Yeah, the guy. Yeah. I'm trying to think of his name, but he was. Hey, which way do you go? I don't know.
He was
the
Jewish comedian. Yeah, which doesn't narrow it down. But,
no,
yeah.
Definitely doesn't. But no, that guy, and they ended up using him. And I think. They still
Dan Aykroyd replaced Bill Murray.
Yeah, they would have left Sam in the movie, but I think Sam walked because they fired Rodney. So
I didn't even know Rodney was a part of it. You know, like agreed to it.
Yeah, at a certain point he was supposed to do it, and they changed out. Jackie Mason is the guy's name.
Mason. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
I knew. I had to think about it for a minute because he was also the voice of that cartoon.
He just passed like a year ago.
Yeah. Yeah, so I know that that he was supposed to be part of that, and okay, so that was gone, and I don't know.
Dan Aykroyd did it as a favor, by the way, too.
Okay, well, I don't know, but like I don't know all this stuff. I just remember Sam talking about it back then because I used to follow everything Sam did.
So you know about him doing a Tuck, that cursed movie that still hasn't been filmed to this day.
Oh, the Eskimo movie, right?
Yeah, a Tuck, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know about that.
They had sets built and everything. He signed on the dotted line, and then I forget what happened. He had the costume fitting and everything. He was the closest out of, like, John Candy or Chris Farley to actually almost make it.
Yeah, what's weird about that is that he had, there's a bunch of things that went on, because remember, he got so bad at one point, he didn't show up on for some gigs, and...
He didn't show up for Confederacy of Dunces either, which is another cursed production.
Okay, I didn't know about that one, but I do know he didn't show up for, remember Joan Rivers had a talk show? And,
yeah, Fox.
Yeah, and so I think he didn't show up on the Joan Rivers show. And this started a whole thing, because I remember that being discussed heavily on the Howard Stern show.
Yeah, that's right.
And Stern, of course, that was another messed up thing that went on where...
they used to call up Bobcat Goldthwait and taunt him and Sam.
Yeah. Which, you know, Bobcat to me, again, not... That used to be the comparison back then. Which one of these two guys you like? I'm like, yeah, Bobcat's nothing.
Well, Bobcat's a nice guy. I met him. He's a very nice guy and a good filmmaker now, too.
Hey, look, I know
dark stuff.
I know he's supposed to be a nice guy, but I'm just saying, as a comedian, to me...
Oh, yeah. It's Sam, no doubt.
You know, Bobcat was just
I picked Sam over Dice, too, and I like Dice.
Yeah, see, now... That's a funny thing with that guy, because he initially was going to be an actor of all sorts.
And he was just a character. Like, he had Jerry Lewis, he did a bunch of different characters, but that one stuck.
Yeah, he
Dice
did.
Dice Man.
Yeah, he did, what did he do? He also did De Niro.
Yep, he did Stallone.
Stallone.
From Barbarino there, Welcome Back, Carter.
Yeah, well, that's not Stallone. You're talking about...
Travolta.
That's Travolta, right. Yeah. But I think he did a Sylvester Stallone, maybe.
He did that, too. Yeah, I screwed it up. I mixed them both.
Yeah, but the other thing was Travolta, and really believable. He was just like this character actor guy, and, yeah, the Dice character, he just got stuck with it.
He kind of had that rebellious Rich Little thing going on.
It was really weird too. I mean, I love the one where he goes out and he smokes a cigarette. That was the whole thing, is him lighting a cigarette for like 10 minutes. Right?
Hickory dickory duck. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and then it's like, okay, now poems. And you know, great trick and all, but
one trick pony.
Well, and also
he sold out the Garden a bunch though. That was he was the first comedian to do that, I think.
Yeah. He got himself in trouble, though, with that whole, his commentary on Jesse Jackson, I think, was the...
Was that the thing? I thought it was this SNL woman, Nora Dunn, who was calling him out and, like, boycotting the show while he was on it, and then he went on Arsenio and started crying and stuff.
Well, there was that, but before that, with the very first Dice album, the one that really sold well... which, you know, I don't know.
Dice
if people,
Rules, I think.
It's something like that. It was either Dice Rules or The Dice Man Cometh.
That's right. Yeah. That might be the one. Yeah,
one of those two. But either way, it had the classic, you know, Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet.
Right.
It had that on it. But at one point, he's talking about Jesse Jackson. And and he goes, well, you know what? If you want to put on a pair of shorts and dribble for the Lakers, that's fine by me, but you ain't running my life. he did that, and it was like, oh, okay.
Was that during one of Jesse's attempts at the presidency?
Yeah, it was probably around the same time that Tootie came to my high school. You've heard that story?
That's right, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Facts of life, baby.
Facts of life, Tootie came to my high school for stumping for Jesse Jackson. It's a true story.
Why don't you remind me of that, just in case other people haven't heard it?
Well, I'm sure everybody's heard this. I mean, look, it's pretty simple. I'm in school one day, no idea this is going to happen, but there's a ruckus a bit in my cafeteria. And I go to walk into the cafeteria, you know, stupid me. I must have walked through the wrong door. I get jacked up by the Nation of Islam, basically. I'm not kidding, by the way. This is guys with the sunglasses, the bow ties, the shaved heads.
Yeah, that was his security.
Yeah, because that's who her security was. So they jack me up and, like, throw me up against the wall and stuff, and I'm like, hey, what the hell is this?
I just want lunch.
You know, seriously, it's like, you know, I just came for some tater tots. What is the problem here? And I'm thinking to myself... And this is another thing, is that we self-segregated in my school, so you had one entire cafeteria that everybody knew was the black cafeteria. White people did not sit in the black cafeteria, okay?
Wow.
So those of us that were there, I mean, I'm not saying that everybody that was in the other cafeteria was white. There wasn't enough.
And this was New Jersey, by the way, not Georgia, where you're in now, where it would be expected.
This is Neptune High School in New Jersey, yes.
Wow.
And so you have the mixed cafeteria, and then you have the black cafeteria. And the one funny thing is, if you were running late, You might run into the black cafeteria to go get your food if you're running late on your lunch period because the line moved faster in the black cafeteria. Anyway, so I'm going into the mixed cafeteria, mind you. And as I'm, you know, getting let go because I'm like, yeah, he's a student, okay. Because, you know, I had a beard and long hair and I did not.
Me too.
You know, I look like I'm. People would confuse me. Some of the, when I was a senior, I think, some of the freshmen started calling me a hacksaw, like Hacksaw Jim Duggan and stuff like this. And others called me Ogre, like from the movie Revenge of the Nerds.
oh, my God.
So that's kind of what I looked like. And, yeah, so they jacked me up. I guess I could kind of see why they would jack me up against the wall. But I had no idea that Tootie was there. So I get a free from these guys and go over to get my food and whatever and realize that the cafeteria is overpacked. They have packed everybody from the black cafeteria into the mixed one. I don't know why they made that choice, but they did. And, yeah, so Tootie comes to the
podium. At least
it
wasn't Natalie.
Well, I don't know. She wouldn't add the Nation of Islam gardener, I think.
That's true.
Anyway, Tootie steps up to the podium. I'm like, for real? It's Kim Field. I'm Kim Fields.
Ridiculous.
And I played Tootie on TV, and I want to talk to you about Jesse Jackson and blah, blah, blah. And she goes on for, I don't know, 10-minute spiel or whatever. Now, does anybody have any questions? Dumbass me. Stick my hand up and go, you know, like, well, look, I've heard about what Reverend Jackson has to say about a lot of stuff, but does he have any clue about how to handle things internationally, or what would he be like as a commander-in-chief, given that he has no experience with handling any of that?
Yes. I thought you were going to be like, what's for lunch?
No, because I already got my food. And, yeah, I did get my food.
Good. That's
but
good.
Other people were not so lucky that day. It was very weird. Anyways, so I got my food. I ate my food, and I listened to her while I ate my food. But then, yeah, anybody got questions? Dumbass me, like I said. So I asked about that and something about nuclear weapons, and the next thing I know, I'm being escorted out of the cafeteria.
You're being dragged out, but would you lay your hair or your beard?
no, by the shoulders. And I'm like, this is just funny. All right, I'm going to go have a cigarette anyway. So I just
you're like, don't tease me, bro, before it was like a thing.
Pretty much. If I would have thought to say it, I would have said it. Yeah, they tossed me out. Anyway, that's
so
my
Phil
whole
Hartman
story.
And Squeaky Fromm, huh?
No, but there's that. Like I said, I was just listening to that documentary, and I was like, really? She went to high school with Phil Hartman. Okay. That just struck me as very weird. But,
he ended up doing, he was a graphic designer. He did, album covers for different bands in the 70s, too. People don't know that, either.
Hmm. Yeah, no, he was doing graphic design work, right.
Yeah.
For some reason... He's
a talented guy. It's unfortunate what happened to him, you know?
No, for sure. It's just, again, victim to, you bring the wrong kind of crazy into your life, and sometimes it hurts. I mean, what can I say? And I totally sympathize. I mean, again, the way they described him with these marriages and stuff is that he'd very much fall right into love and then very much fall right out of love. So, I can understand part of that equation. Just saying.
Only this time, only with this one, he was locked in because he had the two kids, you know?
Well, yeah, but look, as much as that seems locked in when you're in the situation, not necessarily. I mean, anyway.
Anyway, I don't know.
Listen, I had two kids.
Say Andy Dick didn't help the situation.
Yeah, but see, now I don't know if people were fair to Andy Dick because, I mean, according to Andy Dick, because, again, they interviewed him for this documentary, he's like, people need to give me a break here because I gave her cocaine, a little bit, and it was 6 months before this. I mean, you can't say that I'm responsible for this.
But apparently it knocked her off the wagon just enough.
Well, okay, but listen, how...
I mean, John Lovitz punched him out over it, because him and Phil were pretty tight. He was really upset about it.
Well, according to the documentary, he didn't punch him out. He just leaned over when he was in the car one day and whispered in his ear, "I know you killed Bill Hartman."
No, he actually punched him too in a nightclub later on. Right. I don't know how old the documentary is. Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe it was an old one. I don't know. I saw that story and Andy Dick, who doesn't make any bones about the fact that he was partying and stuff. I mean.
Yeah, he did it with Farley, too. Norm MacDonald talked about that.
Yeah, but, you know, you offer somebody drugs. Is it your fault?
Yeah, I know.
You know?
It's all sad.
It's sort of like, okay, so I go to my friend's house, and I'm, look, alcohol's a bad mix for me. I go to my friend's house, he's having a beer, and he offers me a beer. Is it his fault that,
I'm not saying it's Andy Dick's fault. It's just he didn't help matters at all.
No, well, fair enough. But then again, you don't want to be around drugs. Don't be in Hollywood. Don't be in California, in fact.
Man, Pretty much. Tell me about it.
just saying. And that's the thing.
So when you saw, going back, so when you saw Sam, he was pretty coherent. So it was way before his downfall.
Oh, yeah. It was almost exactly the same routine from the HBO set.
I
think there was like a couple of additions where I was like, maybe I'll hear that because it was.
Did he start going into the Elvis bit, like start singing like.
No.
Covering Elvis and stuff. Okay.
No, he didn't do that. He wasn't doing the singing or guitar or none of that stuff. It was still in the, the trench coat and the beret.
Yeah.
And he was...
the best years.
Yeah, no, that's what I think. But, what was it? What was it called? Have You Seen Me Lately? Was the next album. I think that's the one that actually had the songs on it, where he did Wild Thing and...
He did, like, Love Me Tender and all.
Yeah, and then later on he does Mississippi Queen.
Yeah, he did.
but whatever. That was a little later. This was, I can picture the cassette that I owned. The cassette, listen to me. Yeah, it was. It was a cassette.
It was a cassette. Yeah, I had it, too. I had a lime green 78 Cadillac, and I had all the holdovers from, like, the 70s and 80s, all the cassettes, and, yeah.
Nice. Well, no, but on the front cover of the album I'm thinking of, he's holding, a lighter. He's got, like, a lighter that he's got lit, and he's just, like, on the cover, and it just says Sam Kinison. I can't remember what the name of that album was, but
yeah, Have You Seen Me Lately? Wasn't that the one? Or that's the cover songs?
I think Have You Seen Me Lately is the one that's later, and I got that on a CD, and I think it's got like his high school picture on it or something.
I think one of his last albums was like Live from Hell or something.
Mm. Yeah, Live from Hell. That was
that was the one with the corpse joke, the necrophilia thing.
Well, the corpse thing was on the first album.
He brought it back later on. Like he started like closing with that towards the end of his life.
Oh, he did, huh? Well, I don't
remember. Yeah, he got in trouble with the gay community over it too.
You see, I think he went. I know he went into another thing like that. It wasn't exactly the same thing because at first he's like, "So this is an interesting news story." That's where he starts. I don't even know if it was actually a news
right
story.
Right as AIDS starts. Yeah, not the best, not the brightest move. You know?
Well, and that was the other thing, too, is that both him and Dice took heat on that, where it was like, because Kinison's whole thing was, and AIDS has made this a real fun sport. Now I got to touch everything in the bathroom with my foot. And he did that whole bit.
That's right,
but again, mid-80s, and we definitely had the whole, be afraid.
Using the F word, not the swear word, but the other F word that we're not allowed to say anymore.
Yeah, well, there you go. So there was that. I don't even know what the hell I was talking to you about in the first place. But
Sam Kinison, you saw him once. Yeah.
Right. No, and that's the thing. It was pretty much the same routine from the HBO special, but there was a couple of additional pieces like. The HBO special was exactly an hour, I think, and on stage he did like an hour and 20.
Yeah, who else was on the HBO special with him that I get a kick out of? Bill Hicks.
Hmm. Bill Hicks.
They came up together in Houston.
Well, yeah, but I don't remember him being on... Oh, you mean on on Rodney's special.
The Rodney special. Yeah.
No, there was a lot of interesting people on the Rodney Dangerfield specials, yeah.
Are you talking about his actual special with just him?
Yeah, well, okay. But he had, the one there where it was Rodney's routine, you mean?
The Rodney Dangerfield special that, like, broke Sam. Yeah. Bill Hicks is on the same one.
Yeah, but, okay, but there were two. Because
because
Sam did the first one, and
like 84 and then 85.
Yeah. So Sam did the first one, and he was didn't have a hat on or anything.
No, just his hair. And didn't he go into the bit about the wife? Wasn't that the very first bit that like got him like exposure?
Yeah. Well, that was look, you married? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You're not married, huh? Yeah. Well, look, if you ever think of getting married, remember this face. If you get married, that's going to be your face. Yep.
Did you ever see his sitcom, the Charlie Hoover one on Fox?
Tim
Matheson, I think.
Yeah, where he was some figment of the guy's imagination. He was like his conscience.
Exactly. Yeah. It was after he appeared on Married with Children as Al's guardian angel. They scooped him up to do a couple years later to do Charlie Hoover.
Yeah, no, it didn't land. There was a ton of Fox shows that they tried a bunch of different things, and it just did not go well.
Herman's Head.
Herman's Head lasted a little bit. They had, I remember when they first started, they had something called Women in Prison, which
yeah,
was...
Yeah, they had Oops as well about the nuke. The nukes dropped, and there was, like, the people that were left. The show was called Oops.
I don't remember that one. But, no, Married with Children was one of those shows that survived all that stuff. And then there was that
21 Jump Street
and Tracy Ullman. Yeah, well, see, now 21 Jump Street has kind of become a cult thing, and they even had a movie not too long ago with Johnny Depp, right?
There are two of them with Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum, and Johnny Depp came back with the other guy too, Peter. What's his face? Don DeLuise's kid, Peter DeLuise. Yeah, they both cameoed as their characters.
There you go. The original stuff coming out of Fox was pretty funny, and then. They had the Tracy Ullman show, which, of course, gives birth to The Simpsons.
Yep. In Living Color.
But see, now Tracy, now in Living Color, I thought was great, but...
I was.
Simpsons, okay, Tracy Ullman, I thought she sucked. I still think she sucks. I saw her, they launched her on HBO, and I'm going, she is a waste of space. I don't understand why anybody thinks this is funny.
Yeah, she was just on Curb Your Enthusiasm, now that you mentioned it.
Oh, yeah, she was, dating somebody.
Yeah, Larry. Well, Larry, because he didn't want to get, the robber guy, fell in his pool and drowned.
Oh, right. They made her the city councilwoman. That's what
councilwoman.
It was.
Councilwoman. Yeah, she was so annoying, and he had to pretend.
And she's totally obnoxious, and she, just farts and stuff at one point, right?
It was probably really her.
Yeah, no, well, either way, but, that show, people told me for years to watch it, and I never did. About a year ago, I finally, somebody convinced me, Mrs. O did, convinced me to sit down and watch it, and I was like, okay, I don't get this at first, it's, but after a little while, I'm like, this is just ridiculous, obnoxious, and okay, I get it now.
They gave her a bunch of stuff, like Tracy Takes On, I think, years later, and all that.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know how she keeps getting work. I mean, Ricky Gervais is another one who's like okay, but if he doesn't have that guy Carl to pick on, he's not that funny. Yeah. He's just not that funny. I recently.
Well, I like The American Office better. I know that's usually the other way around.
Yeah, well, there's that too. Anyways,
you didn't like it at all, did you?
Yeah. Well, what, The American Office?
Yeah.
No, I'm not into it. I just.
Well, I got you. It's not for everyone.
It's one of those things where I'm like, somebody get to a point here.
I appreciated that they didn't have the stupid laugh track that we've had for, 60 years. You know what I mean? I can laugh when I think something's funny. That was, one of the first shows I saw that did that. They took away the laugh track. That's why I appreciated it in the beginning, at least.
Nah, that's cool. But I'm more of a,
Married with Children?
I don't know. Married with Children's good. I'm more of a Dave Chappelle guy when it comes to...
Chappelle Show, dude. Oh, of course.
You know, you want to go to a skit show, Chappelle is just superior to most. But anyways...
Oh, yeah.
But who knows what else is going to come up on Get Mad with Chris Graves, because there's going to be a lot. And guess what? We're out of time for tonight. Now, hopefully I'll get Celly Castillo on tomorrow. And I don't know what happened with my first hour guest, but I think it was just a problem connecting. We'll sort it out. We'll get some other people on. But as it stands, it looks like we had Chris Graves in the second hour. We had Jimmy James mostly in the first hour. And, hey, it was a Wednesday, so there you have it. I'll see you guys again tomorrow night on Thursday. Mike Swanson should be with me, and like I said, I'll try and get Celly Castillo to stand in the second hour, because Larry Hancock is not well. So we'll get an update on that pretty soon, as soon as I know I can share that with everybody. But anyway, no matter who you are, where you are, I'm Mirlio Celli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.